Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
Andrea Lopez Villafana is out this week. She's feeling great. She's not sounding very great, though. Coming up on this, this is all bad.
Damn it.
Gotta do this again. Ready? 3, 2. Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by reporter Jacob McWinney. What's up, Jacob?
I'm doing good. You sound much more enthused on this take.
Okay, thanks. Also in the house, senior investigative reporter who's not a senior yet. You're just
regular.
A senior investigative reporter. You're more senior than some others.
Yes, but not senior.
Will Hunsberry, how are you?
Good.
Andrea Lopez Villafana, otherwise known as Lopez, is out this week. Coming up on the show, San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria is proposing a change to the city's landmark Complete Communities housing plan. It allowed developers to build much larger projects if they included affordable housing. Now they could build that affordable housing, at least if this passes, in poorer communities rather than on site. We'll talk about that and explain what's going on. And we commissioned our old pal, Andrew Donahue, used to be the co-host on this very show, to do a dive into what's happened at the Union Tribune since L.A. billionaire Patrick Soon-Shin betrayed us, sold the paper to the most feared hedge fund in the American newspaper world. Donahue's going to call in and talk about the story that everyone's talking about this week. It's going to be a good show. Stay with us. Can't let the week go by without discussing this incredible clip from KUSI News. Shout out to Ken Stone from Times of San Diego, who saw this and posted it for all our delight. So this is one of the anchors at KUSI, Lindsay Fucano. She had to do the weather, and this is we're all dealing with the dry air. You were talking about your face.
Yeah. My nosebleeds have been not very nice.
And I
don't do anything
illicit
that would cause them.
Like, it's just gasping.
Hot,
for
dry winds. Some of you may have heard of them.
Sometimes. Well, Lindsay was dealing with them on the weather forecast here.
All right, so the big story that we are looking at, we are feeling this warm up here in San Diego, and it is all due thanks in part to the Santa Ana winds. And I didn't know what they were. Rafer had to look it up as well. But this is when actually the winds, they move offshore, and the descending air, it's from the desert. So it heats up the hot and windy conditions that we've been experiencing.
Wow.
So when I was at City College, I did a semester of the TV news program there. Yeah. It was not by any fault of City College people, but it was a terrible experience because every single time I would go on, I would sweat profusely and just be like nervous the whole night before. This sounds terrifying. having to be doing the weather.
I admire the vulnerability. Like you come across a concept like the Santa Ana winds, you're like, man, we had to Google the hot air, the desert.
This does feel like
blowing.
This does feel like a TV journalist like version of like the nightmare of showing up to school with like just in your underwear, you know?
I know she's probably mortified, and I don't want to pile on, but I gotta deal with it. Also that part, well, it's like the desert, so it's warm. It's just like,
it's the worst advertisement for like the value of local news as well, right? Like we just sit around Googling stuff you all already knew exactly what it was.
I mean, also maybe it's a good advertisement for other local news.
Well, yes, we know what the Santa Anas are, guys.
The graphic guy knew, or the graphic lady knew what they were. They got the arrows flowing.
Surely the graphics people had seen them before.
And they must have been like, draft the Santa Anas! There's no core concept in local climatology in San Diego. Nothing more important than the Santa Ana wind. Not the sun, not the tides.
Not the Colorado River.
Not the river.
That sounds like a little bit of exaggeration.
No
here,
way.
Scott.
What concept in local weather is more important than the Santa Ana wind? It's the only interesting thing about the place. There's no more interesting weather that occurs here than the Santa Ana wind. Even the hurricane, it comes every 30 years. They're like, well, it rained. It just rained.
So in her defense, do we know how long she's been here?
Yeah, that's a great question.
So she grew up in Southern California.
Okay, guilty. Guilty, guilty, wow. Guilty.
Misdemeanor or felony?
I think this is probably a meteorological felony.
I think so.
Just like a person? No,
she's not a meteorologist. She's they're like, hey, you gotta do the weather tonight. And she was probably like, what?
And this is her worst nightmare of what would happen.
This is definitely.
And it happened. I do feel bad for her.
Yes. Let's just be clear. We respect and value her as a professional in town. We're not piling on. It's just an interesting thing.
It could happen to any of us, you know. It's like when a reporter first learns about the property tax law bill from the 70s, you know, it blows your mind. Yeah.
Sure, but I don't know that the property tax law makes like your face dry every single year.
Yeah, or cause the fires. the only unique scary thing we have to deal with. Every other weather is just like, do I need a coat in the morning or my warm shirt? That's the entirety.
That's the question, 365.
Yeah. So, can I use this opportunity to explain something?
Give us some news here.
I don't think we have any choice, right?
It's my platform. It's fine. Everybody thinks that the Santa Ana winds are warm because they come from the desert. There's like this heating factory and it pumps over the air.
Sounds right.
It's not true. So actually, the Santa Ana winds come from Utah. Like the Mormons.
The way you started that, you're just so listeners can understand. You started to point to me, and the Santa Ana winds come from you, and you're pointing to me, and I'm like, what did I do?
Utah.
I get it now, but for a second there, I was very concerned.
It gets cold in Utah, and what happens is that air comes rushing down, and then it goes over the mountains as cold air. So at the top of the mountains, when the Santa Ana winds come, they're like freezing. It's super cold. But it goes so fast down the mountain that it heats up and it becomes like this hot wind that comes past it. So everybody, again, it's not like some factory of hot air blowing on us.
Interesting. It's the speed that creates the heat.
Yeah. Wow. It's wild.
So much of the way winds work just sounds like a cartoon from the 50s. I'm never going to be able to understand it fully.
Yeah. Well, SDG&E taught me that. I went to the emergency, you know, place where they shut off the power. If they have this entire system set up. This is very, very.
Do they just have like a big red button?
It's like this NASA, like lab, you know, screens and everything. And the entire purpose of it is when to push the button to turn off power. And it's all.
I'm glad they take that seriously.
Absolutely.
It's like the Wile E. Coyote command center.
So anyway, that's how Santa Ana winds work. And I, you know, if they need me to sub.
You would have nailed it, man.
I've been like, hey, take a second.
I don't know, Scott, do you know what to do with your hands when you're up there?
I'm pretty good with my hands. Okay. I don't know if you know this. I was huge on TV for a while.
Yeah, but Scott had a segment, a weekly segment.
Okay, we want to also cover a couple of updates. First up, the Cardenas siblings. Wow.
Wow.
All right. So Andrea Cardenas is city councilwoman in Chula Vista. We've had her on this podcast before, live podcast in Chula Vista, and we actually asked her some tough questions in that conversation about her, how she's a city councilwoman while also being a political consultant that represents, you know, like some of these cannabis places,
right,
that are trying to get like regulations and laws from the city, right?
Yeah, super above board stuff, right?
It's a tough balance.
Okay,
and as she pointed out,
okay, Andrea.
And then her brother is Jesus Cardenas, who used to be the chief of staff for Stephen Whitburn, city councilman at the city of San Diego, and now the chair of MTS. And after he became the chair of MTS because of that crazy story about the previous chair that we don't need to get into, his chief of staff, Jesus Cardenas, had to quit because it was discovered that that political consulting firm that he and his sister run was collecting fees improperly because they were not allowed to. They were suspended. Anyway, a lot of balancing of this private job and company and the public responsibility. Well, this week, District Attorney Summer Steffen charged Jesus Cardenas and Andrea Cardenas with felony counts about money laundering, fraudulent stuff, other fraudulent stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it was a list.
It was a long list
of fraudulent
stuff.
It was
a baker's dozen of offenses.
All not in regard to some of these conflicts we've explored, but in regard to the political consulting firm that they run. She says that they applied for one of the Paycheck Protection Plan?
PPP loans.
PPP loans that the government provided during COVID. The basic deal with the loan was if you have employees and you keep them on your payroll during COVID, then the government would give you this loan. You don't have to pay it back. You just get the money. Full disclosure, Voice San Diego guy, everybody got. Your employer didn't. You became unemployed. Right?
I became unemployed twice over, yeah.
Okay, sorry. It is alleged that the Cardenas and their firm, Grassroots Resources, got one of these PPP loans, claimed 34 employees, but the employees, it turns out, were actually employees of a cannabis distributor. And cannabis is illegal still on the federal government's terms.
Right.
And so, you know, they're not qualified.
No PPP loans allowed
to get the
for
PPP
them.
Loan. Mm-hmm. And also, they don't have 34 employees for this firm. And it's a political consulting firm. There was questions about whether that would make them eligible for this. And so the DA said they lied about all these things. They laundered money in the process. And therefore, they're going to be charged now with these felonies. So
wow.
It's a huge story in local politics.
This is no small thing. Doesn't Andrea face like nearly 6 years in prison if she's convicted of all of this?
And, yes,
and
there's
Jesus something like four.
Yeah, they both face some pretty serious time. There, you know, obviously there's going to be all kinds of discovery and all kinds of time for deals or pleas or different things to happen. Innocent till proven guilty, all of those things. So. But it's a huge story in local politics. I think there'll be pressure on her to resign. There'll be pressure on other things to happen. We'll see how that all carries out. So big story and update. We'll follow it from the district attorney on that.
And Andrea's up for re-election.
Yes.
Right? Could she pull like a Eugene Debs and run from prison?
Yeah.
They may try to extract from her a promise never to run for office again. That's one thing they
work on. Or to resign. Yeah.
You're right.
They often, that is part of the deals often with these cases. So we shall see.
Should we say La Prensa broke the original story about the PPP loan?
That's right. The La Prensa had a long story, and the second half of it was in February about how odd the PPP loan was, how some of the questionable claims they made in it. So,
but the publisher, does the publisher have friction with Jesus Cardenas?
Art Castaneris has some history with Cardenas.
The interesting dynamic there.
There's a lot of beefs around San Diego. I think that's listed among them. Can I do this one last update? Palomar Health. So Tigas has been on this story. This is fascinating.
It's wild, this one.
She's been dogging this agency for a while for their finances and other things, like doing a great job holding them accountable. But one day she goes onto the website and it has this big interstitial that comes up and says, you must sign this terms of service before you agree, before you can go onto the website. And she looks through the terms and they're like, you can't copy anything, you can't reproduce anything, you can't post anything from this site without written consent from Palomar Health. Palomar Health is a public government agency. Like, you can't go to the city of San Diego and have the city of San Diego say, you can't take any of this stuff. That's our stuff. We absolutely can take it.
These public meeting agendas, you cannot republish it.
We can take it, absolutely. So she, in the process of sort of examining this, she talked to these lawyers, and they're like, yeah, that's crazy that that would be that. And she talked to one of the board members, Lori Edwards Tate. And she said, this seems a little bit questionable.
Bit much.
Yeah. And the Palomar Health sent this director a threat and said that and scheduled on their meeting that they were going to vote to censor her for speaking to Tigas Lane.
Potentially even a vote of no confidence or something.
Like, so is that something?
For saying to Tigas Lane that this policy is weird. An elected official, they're elected, right?
Yeah.
An elected official wanted to speak out about a policy of their board, and their board was like, you can't do that.
So technically, by their policy, would we have been breaking it if we reported that on their board meeting, they listed that they were going to do a vote of no confidence?
They ended up changing the terms.
Yeah.
But yes, exactly. Like, you take like the agenda, like, oh, you didn't give us consent to post the agenda.
Who are
of
these
when
people?
When we're going to vote no confidence for the comment about the consent that we didn't give for this terms of service.
It's pretty baller to like be hit with some, you know, critical coverage and then just be like, no, you can't look at any of this. You can't talk about any of this. Our whole website is off limits. Right. I kind of have to respect that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, anyway, the development this week is that Lori Edwards Tate, that director, is suing Palomar Health for what she says is now an infringement on her First Amendment rights to say things to people.
I'm going to say as she should. I'm going to go ahead and say as she should.
And they're mad. You might understand. They said, quote, Palomar Health is disappointed Director Edwards Tate chose to file a baseless lawsuit grounded in her misunderstanding of Palomar Health's media policy. While all directors have a right to speak to the public, Palomar Health encourages board members to notify someone on the executive leadership team when they intend to speak to the media, ensuring that information is accurate. Instead, Director Edwards Tate chose to forego verification.
Have you been practicing that Palomar Health voice?
And as a result, disseminated false and misleading information. Of course, they never say, and they never have said, what is inaccurate. And every time they accuse Tigas of writing something inaccurate, they're like, you ask them, like, what? What was wrong? And they're like, it just was wrong.
They seem to, I don't know if they all went to PR school or what, but they seem to think they have some fundamental constitutional right to check people's talking points before they say them. And they just really read the Constitution wrong.
Well, hopefully she schools them. All right, we're joined on the line by none other than my former co-host on this show.
Weird World.
The first co-host of the Voice San Diego podcast, Andrew Donahue. What's up, dude?
Hey, man. It's good to be back. I'm I'm happy to know you didn't ruin the show.
Yeah. It's much better, actually, since you left.
I imagine it's way better. I know. I haven't listened to it. So
was it just
know.
You two, like, sitting in a closet? Like,
no, we would go to Kogo. We would drive, yeah. And we would plan the show on the way there. Nice. Now we have, like, a whole thing we do, and we have script and all this stuff. But back then, it was just like, hey, what should we talk about?
It was two dudes in an old Volvo coming up with an agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. I can still smell that Volvo. That was a good car. Well, it was like a throwback. You had a byline and voice, and also you wore a Scooby costume for Halloween. Flashback to 20 years ago before the Cedar Fire, we wore, he and I dressed, he was...
Oh, you just told this story the other day.
Yeah, he was Shaggy and I was Scooby. And now he has got a Scooby costume this week, and he's got a byline in Voice San Diego.
It's wow. Like
the time is a flat circle.
This was my 20-year life reunion today, or this week, yeah.
All right, so you dug in to the Union Tribune and what happened with the sale. I think one of the biggest sort of takeaways of your story and what we've learned since then is that this hedge fund bought the Union Tribune, and we're starting to understand better that, ironically, as it sort of vulture extracts money away from the paper, it may actually keep the physical paper around longer than if the UT had been left in the caretaking sort of world of this billionaire from LA and the former editor and publisher, Jeff Lack. Can you help us understand what's going on there?
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the key, one of the key takeaways. And one of the things that I sort of came away from that was, I was talking to somebody, and the way that they described it like this was, if you are a newspaper planning for the future, you are doing a digital transformation plan that is built around preserving the jobs of journalists. Because if you're doing a digital transformation plan, you have to make a product that's good enough for people to pay online. And that's quite a high hurdle. So that if you're running a paper like this and trying to transition to digital, you got to protect reporter jobs and cut everywhere else, which is kind of why the Union Tribune was experimenting with these days without print, because that's a way that they could cut costs.
Yeah, days without prints, and then also like more paywalls on the site, like trying to trigger people to buy digital subscriptions.
Yeah, and you have to, again, that has to be a focus on quality to get people to do that online. So Alden comes in. Alden doesn't plan for the future. Alden, you know, basically locks in looking for cash flow. It takes that cash flow, and all it wants to do basically is continue to deliver as many newspapers to the doorsteps of as many people in San Diego, basically until that just doesn't work anymore, and then they sell it off for parts, or maybe they've already sold it off for parts and it just closes, or it gets sold again in some sort of shell. But the biggest takeaway, is they are committed to preserving the print product, which means you'll do anything you can and you'll cut anywhere you can to preserve a newspaper landing on people's door. And that means when they came in and they've cut what employees estimate to be 30% of the staff already, and then you preserve print. So very simply, if you're somebody in San Diego who's concerned, like, oh, I really like my print newspaper, well, you're still going to get it, but it might not have much inside of it, and it's not going to have nearly the quality that it may have before. And again, to drive that home, at least 30% is what employees are guessing. They haven't gotten a firm figure. And if that's the case, the newspaper is now about 80% or more smaller than it used to be. And I mean by newsroom staff. So you used to have up to 400 people working in a newsroom, that now you have somewhere around 75, and you know who knows where it keeps going from there.
Well, you know, I think that's what I didn't understand, what you teased out in this story, Andy, was that everybody's been going around calling Alden strip miners, and I didn't really understand how that worked because all the papers they've bought are still open, you know, and you keep hearing people say Alden's going to sell it for parts. Alden's going to sell it for parts. And I think finally I understand what that means, which is that they're going to print the paper, which is cash to them, as long as they possibly can. And they're going to keep cutting jobs until, and the next stage is just disappearance potentially, instead of there being a transition plan.
Yeah. And I think it's harder to know. It's harder to know like exactly when that runs out. You know, when do those lines in the chart converge where there's not enough subscribers to bring in even any cash flow? And then what do they do? Like, we haven't gotten there yet. And people have been predicting that, and they thought it was going to happen before. And I talked to somebody who said, you know, they thought maybe a couple years ago it was about 3 years. They think the pandemic kind of changed that a little bit, because there was a big boost in like digital subscriptions, just in newspapers in general. And so I think the question is like, how long is that runway, right? But I think what we do know is, you know, you have an owner, even like plenty of these other corporate owners that you've had in the past, they at least had some commitment or like history or investment in journalism. Mm-hmm. Or if you're a private equity firm, you go in, you try to cut costs, make it a solvent business, and then quickly sell it again to somebody else who's interested in running a newspaper. What it appears to be with these guys is no real interest in journalism, and just an interest in the you know, nice fat profit margin they could build out of a newspaper until that newspaper bleeds dry. You know, there's no like, let's make sure that this is some sort of ongoing, you know, institution in the community. Now, like, there are plenty of, there's still hardworking reporters and editors and people there who are trying to make it work and are committed, but the institution itself is not committed to San Diego and not necessarily committed to journalism. You know?
I think just to drive home what we're talking about here, there's one idea of keeping journalism going and getting people to pay for it differently. And then the other, and just cutting all costs, including the print paper, as much as possible to keep it going. And then the alternate being cutting the journalism as much as possible,
so
that you can keep the products alive as long as possible, and extract as much from that as possible. I think one of the really interesting parts of the story, you had a bunch of comments from people who you protected their names just because of what was pretty clearly a hostility from Alden and the new owners to the reporters and others talking about what was happening. And one of them was saying, like, look, this is hard and we're having trouble, but I don't really blame these guys. These guys have been very clear about what they want, that their hostility seems to be about the previous owner, Patrick Soon-Shin.
Absolutely. I mean, they're like, you know, everybody's like, look, we know what these guys are about and this is what they're doing, and they don't agree with it. But the you know, Patrick came in, you know, he sort of got the Union Tribune as, you know, you can either say as a throw-in or as something he had to accept as part of buying, you know, buying the LA Times.
Seems like it's, you know, the latter now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm a big NBA fan, and you have a lot of trades recently where there's somebody with a terrible contract who gets thrown in. It's like, yeah, if you want this good player, you got to have the guy who's making $30 million who barely plays anymore. And it feels like, you know, it doesn't feel like he was ever really invested in San Diego, but he took in the paper as part of wanting his hometown paper, which is the LA, you know, the LA Times. And, you know, he came down, gave one speech, kind of an off-putting speech for the people there. But then he went back to LA and just kind of left the paper alone. In a lot of ways, that was sort of like the boom, you know, the boom years there. They were making money. They were starting to carve out this digital plan for the future. And it felt like in a lot of ways, people there, that it had really stabilized. You know, the newspapers were in a free fall. And they stabilized, and that's when, like, you know, you start to see more financial future being around the subscriptions. And Patrick, from what I've been told, sort of really projects himself as a savior, right? Like, he's a guy who is trying to cure cancer. You know, he tried to create a COVID vaccine, and he really did position himself as somebody who was coming in to save local news. And so That's why it was particular. It felt like a particular betrayal to the people there, and you know, to them, the larger community of San Diego. For him, in you know, out of absolutely nowhere, to turn around and sell the paper, and not just sell the paper, but turn it into you know, to sell it to the one company that you could pretty much guarantee was not going to be invested in San Diego or in local journalism. That I think that. It's the thing that everybody's really mad at. And, you know, there have been various attempts to try to turn the newspaper into a nonprofit at different times. And that was one of the questions that kept coming up from people was sort of, you know, why didn't, if he had to sell, why did he have to sell so quickly and suddenly? And why couldn't he have tried to, you know, go back and try to make one of these nonprofit sort of negotiations work, you know? And he is a billionaire. Right. So it's hard to, I mean, I don't know his cash flow or his, you know, in finances, but it's kind of hard to believe that if the paper was making money, that there was some sort of, that he like financially had to get out of there, urgently, unless, you know, again, unless there's some other thing that I have no idea about.
Well, that was a question that I had, right? I mean, by all accounts, it seems like the UT was making money and wasn't this huge, massive dead weight. On Patrick Soon-Shin, but as you alluded to it just now and in the story, there were other options. Can you kind of explore a little bit of what those were and kind of expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, in the past, so under I guess it would have been a few owners ago, Doug Manchester, there were some pretty serious negotiations with Malin Burnham, the local philanthropist, who was really, you know, intent on you know, really believed in the actual Union Tribune, the newspaper, as being like the center of this information and news hub. And he really wanted, he thought it was a community service and it should be sort of treated that way. So he worked with a group of like a bunch of financial heavyweights in town to come up with a plan to try to convert the Union Tribune, basically pay Doug Manchester to buy it from him and then convert it to a nonprofit organization. Now that was what is going to require Manchester to give them the newspaper at a discount, which I don't know Manchester at all, but from what I've heard of him, the idea that he would just give the newspaper away at a discount, I think, you know, obviously was probably a long shot to begin with. But they really tried. And from what I've been told, it was, they spent like a year or so really digging in. There's a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of tax issues with converting something from a for-profit to a nonprofit, and you know, there's a lot of fundraising that was going to go into it. Now, from what I was told, the you know, they went to a few of the big, you know, usual suspects for fundraising, and nobody bought. But I'm told that, you know, Burnham did still really think that he could gather the cash necessary. Manchester ended up taking a deal to sell it for $85 million to the Tribune Company. So that whole project was kind of squashed by that. But fast forward a couple more years, you know, Patrick has I think he has like some ties with Arizona State University, and also Arizona State's journalism school has a real like teaching hospital model where they really take their students and put them into real world situations. So they're actually reporting stories and, you know, working in newsrooms and stuff. So apparently there was some pretty, there were some negotiations about, could you basically convert the Union Tribune to a nonprofit and then have the Arizona State University use it as a teaching hospital? And from what I've been told, that like the San Diego Foundation would have been like some sort of like the financial steward of it or something like that. But again, that got very complicated from what I heard on both sides of it. There were hangups. And didn't end up coming to fruition. But I don't know. I don't know if that means that you could never have done it. But I do think, like, now that you have Alden there, the chances of it happening are probably pretty low.
Well, that's I think that's my biggest question that still remains about this is you talked about, like, why did he actually sell it? Because if you think about the story, what's going on, the Jeff Light, the leader of it, is in the middle of this multi-year plan to you know, bridge the gap into the digital future. They're not losing money by all accounts. There's nothing emergency. There's no emergency at the moment. And so for him to sell right away just felt like this intense betrayal. And the only thing I can conclude is that he wasn't out there on the market at all. I suspect that Alden went to him and offered something that their whole family's like, well, I can't. There's no way for us to say that this is not something we can take, right? Like that they have to,
and which is the whole problem.
Not have
though,
to, but
with like, you know, the best model we've seen to save journalism in the past decade is billionaire largesse. And like billionaire largesse leaves just as quickly as it comes. You know, it is not going to fix the model. It might give us runway sometimes when it comes into play, but like we've seen, I think you're right. It seems like the most likely scenario is Alden approached them. It was a number they felt like was too good to be true. And like, turns out all that talk about protecting the UT was hot air, whether he meant it to be or not.
Right.
Well, and to be fair, there wasn't all that much talk about protecting the UT. There was like one speech and then just complete radio silence for years, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any reporting that would, you know, that would support or contradict what you're talking about, Scott. I mean, I don't know. I would say that he never was committed here, you know, so the fact that ultimately he sold isn't very surprising, you know. I think the fact that it was so sudden. I mean, literally in the story, like people are just working on a Monday and then all of a sudden like they get an email and then the dude from Alden is just walking around them asking them what they do in the office. Like, you know, in previous sales, like these were things that had, you know, you knew they were on the market and everything. I think, you know, I think he was never committed to San Diego. You know, finances changed too. We do know that like a lot of things that have bedeviled like the previous owners of the Union Tribune and previous efforts to try to make it into a nonprofit is the pension debt. So, you know, it may have been profitable now. Maybe it wasn't going to be profitable. Maybe they had projections it wasn't going to be profitable in the future. And, you know, they did have to make cuts at the LA Times and maybe, I don't know, this is again speculation. Maybe he didn't want to, you know, be the owner of a place that was going to have to go do more cuts. I don't know. I mean, you know, they were also out there. Jeff Light was out there in a Q&A on their own site talking about how profitable they were, and they were profitable in the right way. So I guess, Scott, to your theory, if an Alden guy has got a Google alert for profitable newspapers.
Let's go.
You know, that was the speed with which everything happened was one of the more interesting, I think, pieces of this story. And just how surreal kind of the UFO of Alden guys coming in and dropping into the UT and walking around like an AI sort of model. I mean, could you kind of walk us through what it felt like for the UT staff once this sale did go public and how, you know, 5 minutes later there's like an Alden dude who seems like he's artificial intelligence walking around?
Yeah, it's like the call is coming from inside the house, kind of thing. Like he was just there. Yeah, I mean, I think it was very disturbing, honestly, for people. And you know, from what I've been told, it's, you know, they are all their, you know, the staff meetings are this guy Ron Haas, who you know, is delivering them basically like he's just reading from a script. They're not taking questions from people live. They are, you know, if there is questions, you have to turn them into an email beforehand. And, you know, they're being threatened too. They're saying like, they're being told repeatedly, if any of this information leaks, we're not going to be giving you more information, which, you know, obviously cuts people off from wanting to talk and made people very scared in talking to me for the story. But also it's kind of weird because they're not actually giving them any information anyways. So I wonder what the real, like, what's the threat? Like they're saying, like, we're not getting any plans for the future. We're not being told much anyways. But it is, you know, it does seem quite robotic, to be honest. You know, I think that's the way a lot of people described it, in the sense that like they're, you know, they cut right away, you know, parental leave, for example. They cut the 401k match. They, you know, there's people have been told there's not going to be raises. There's not like any avenue for pay increases or merit raises or anything like that. And so, you know, we all know working in newspapers or in the news business is not often a pretty picture, and isn't the most lucrative endeavor. But it does feel like, you know, both there's like just a certain there's just a certain playbook that they follow in this, and it doesn't seem to be very concerned about retaining talent, you know, or attracting talent or ensuring that people are happy in the workplace. As a matter of fact, I mean, I put this in the story, but at a number of other Alden newspapers, people like not just describe like poor working conditions, like, oh, I'm getting asked to do seven stories, but it's like there's rats and mildew and there's no hot water in the bathroom. And it's like, you know, we have breathing problems because they moved our office near a plant and stuff. And it's like, it's actually like, there's actually, you know, sort of like working hazards too.
Well, one of the things I think you drive home to with the piece and is that the institution of this, that we all need to keep in mind that, like it or hate it, the UT was an institution in town that provided to some extent a public service.
Yeah.
And as you described, this is the first time now since they unloaded printing presses into Old Town in what was it, 1840 or something?
1868.
Okay, yeah. 1868, they unloaded printing presses, and there was a headquarters for the newspaper or newspapers in San Diego from that moment until just this year, where there is no headquarters for a local daily newspaper anywhere. They're working online.
All remote workers.
All remote.
We have an office.
Yeah.
We have 13, 14 employees. We have a headquarters.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you're really behind the times.
I know, right? But I think that's a symbol of what is bigger, which is that this institution and its future cannot be sort of counted on any longer. I think that the story I've been trying to tell for a long time is like newspapers did a public service in the sense that they had this product, and it was churning out so much wealth through its advertising model that it could foster and incubate this public service alongside of it. And as that engine sort of changed and was ultimately disrupted so completely by the internet, at that point, that incubation, that cultivation of the public service just withered away. And we were lucky. It was just like this historic anomaly is this like convenience that we had, that public service, as flawed as it was, as unrepresented as it was, as unrepresentative as it was, as just, you know, whatever problems and flaws it had, it was a public service that was being delivered, and we were kind of like, it was just this weird,
just like, people being there, like whether the press is doing a good job or not, when they're there, when they're going to meetings, that alone counts for an immense amount. And but you know, I think like something that happened over the course of that 100 years you're talking about, like the press became like so professionalized as an institution. It went from being this like blue collar enterprise where people knew what it was and knew what it was about. And then it got cronkitized eventually to the point that it was this view from nowhere stuff. And as dire as this all is, like, this is how we reinvent ourselves to become more relevant.
Well, that's what I was going to, we were providing through this sort of historic accident, this service. And it became, as you said, like so professional and contained in that world. And now we're being challenged to like figure out how to deliver that service directly, as opposed to through some alternate commercial activity that was going on. And I think it gets back to the last point in your piece and the different parts where you explored all these different ways that other people were thinking about delivering it directly, whether it's Arizona State or a nonprofit or whatever. But that's the challenge we're all left with, is are we going to be able to build an institution or institutions that can deliver that public service directly, maybe more efficiently, and maybe with better sort of foundational priorities and principles going forward? Or do we just fail and nobody knows what's going on?
Yeah. Back to the town, you know, caller days.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Scott, we started off the conversation and like, this is a real throwback week for me. With the Scooby-Doo outfit and being back on the show, like I was also taken back to like these, you know, the speech you just gave, you know, you and I used to give in meetings to funders like 15 years ago. And the whole idea was like, you know, the whole baseline was journalism is at the core of public service. It used to get provided by the market, But now the market's not providing it. And so we have to get used to people paying for it in another way. And how do we pay for public services that aren't provided by the market? Largely through philanthropy, right? And so what I was driven home to me was, you know, when Burnham went and met with some of these funders, they said, oh, no, I don't fund. That's not something I fund. I fund medical research and education and everything like that. And it just speaks to the fact that, like, we are still, as a community and a society, pretty far behind the curve on what's happening in that 15 years. That newspaper has shrunk to be, you know, the newsroom is 1/5 of its size. But we haven't actually caught up to the fact that, like, we're going to have to fund this through philanthropy. And the thing that gives me, like, hope is that we actually know how to fund things through philanthropy. Like, as I put in the story, like, San Diego knows how to do that. $90 million a year go to the Symphony Association. Like, they have revenues of $90 million a year. You know, the museums have $30 million. Like, you know, what's Voice's budget? $2 million?
It's a solid $2 million.
Is it a solid? It's,
it is a robust.
Shut up,
Will. It is a robust, well-earned $2 million. But and the other point I make is that, like, and this is the point that you and I used to try to make, and clearly we haven't been successful, but maybe we can now with this staring us in the face, is that, like, is you know, if you care about all these other things, you know, if we don't have journalism, like, all those things go to waste, yeah. Right? Like, if we don't have journalists covering the school board, then it just got more opaque. It got less responsive and less accountable. If we don't have journalists covering the city, guess what? It's way easier for a parks or beach, you know, somebody in charge of parks or beaches or playgrounds or whatever to be corrupt. And so it's shown that where newspapers close, people vote less. And where newspapers don't exist or aren't strong, people don't know their neighbors as well. And so, like, there's a whole cascading effect here on San Diego of this newspaper. And I think, like, the key is you know, we do know people are stepping up and starting to fund things, but, like, can they do it in time before, like, the whole enterprise is just gone? Because, you know, I'll get off my soapbox in a second, but, like, we're also in a moment where, like, the actual real democracy is a threat in the United States, and the erosion of local news is directly a part of that story as well.
We believe in telling the story and a shared story in San Diego of shared facts, common facts, so we can all understand each other better. And that was a great story. I appreciate you producing it for our site. You are now the investigative editor for Cal Matters, our partners up there. Congratulations. I look forward to you revealing some things and holding some people accountable, huh?
Hey, thanks, man. It was fun to do this story for Voice and fun to be back on the show.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzan, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover Seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com.
So there's a story that broke this week. The mayor's office and city staff want to change the plan, the community plan for Hillcrest, allow taller buildings, allow maybe some one-way streets, try to traffic calm while also allowing more people to live there, more infrastructure, a little LGBTQ historic district, all kinds of interesting things. But one of the big takeaway for
the skyscrapers
for a lot of people was that they were going to allow 30 stories, buildings, and a lot of people are very worried about that.
It looked like a very futuristic building too. It was opaque and red. And
NBC, you know. I don't know where they got this. They did a rendering of what a tower of sorts would look like in Hillcrest, and it's just this big red, like
30-story Jolly Rancher,
lightsaber. It's so classic. Every once in a while, so there's renderings where people want to sell you on something. And then there's renderings where people just try to demonstrate what something might look like. And those are two different things. And they're very different. There's like the one that came out about the old town, the Spey War, the Nav War Center. And it was going to be these buildings. And they were and it was just these like gray blocks that were like blocking everybody's like views and everything. It was like engineered to generate antipathy toward their project.
So you're describing like an agitprop rendering.
Yeah, and so this one is these towers sticking out. Now at the heart of this is of course this ongoing debate and tension about do we allow growth in certain areas, allow people to live closer together? Is there enough infrastructure to support people living more densely in places like Hillcrest, you know, the suburban area of Hillcrest, or not? This debate will go on. Now, Mayor Kevin Faulkner and City Council in 2020 passed the Complete Communities Plan, which allows you developers to build much bigger buildings than they might normally be allowed in some of these zoning areas if it's close to transit and if they
add affordable units to the building on site.
Now, you did a story this week, Will Huntsbury, about a change that is now being proposed for that. Describe what the change would mean.
Yeah, it's a really interesting change, and I was surprised nobody had covered it re our last discussion of the UT. This just kind of slipped by unnoticed to the press, but the idea is that we water down that requirement and we no longer require developers to build the affordable units on the site themselves to the same standard those market rate units will be built. We allow them to build them off-site and potentially in poor neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So some people really don't like that.
Yeah, so that was an incredible comment from Councilman Joe LaCava. So he represents La Jolla, some of these other areas, and I think kind of out of character for a stereotype for that sort of representative was like, you know, how can you consider it? So the idea is that if you're required to build affordable housing in those buildings, it would support sort of economic diversity.
Right.
It would keep maybe some lower income folks who have been able to live there for now, maybe keep some of their spots. And he was like, you know, if you support allowing people to build their affordable units elsewhere, you're harking back to a time when we used to not allow people of color to live in areas like this.
Right. Redlining, all these things. Like, he came out so fierce on it.
And I'd actually never heard the phrase poor doors. That was an interesting turn of phrase.
Well, there was that project downtown where it was notorious because they'd created an entrance for the or they designed an entrance for, you know, the people who live there.
Oh, undesirables.
And then they had a different entrance for the affordable housing one. So then that's that concept. Yeah.
Interesting.
But I think they got rid of that. That was changed.
And I will just agree. I mean, I LaCava is not somebody who generally is very fiery up there from the podium, but that those comments were clearly aimed at you know, this concept of moving these affordable units outside of these buildings in a way that was fiery. I mean, shoot.
Yeah.
Now the argument for it is that it is already so expensive to build these affordable units that we're always hearing these stories about $700, $800, $900, $1 million per unit to build these affordable housing units. If you require that they be built on this most expensive of land, then you're just adding to that. And it'll be harder for these developers to provide both the normal market supply and the affordable supply both. And so we would be hurting ourselves unless we allow people to fulfill that responsibility in other places. So that's the other side of this. And so I think that's the kind of principle they have to decide between, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument that now if they do this, it'll free up developers to market rate. Developers can build market rate houses, which is what they're good at. And then they can subcontract the affordable units to affordable developers, which is what they're good at. They can access federal funds to do that. And that all makes sense that it could lead to more units. What you have not seen in this discussion at all, though, is like how well is Complete Communities working right now? Because like we said, Complete Communities was ushered in 2020. It allowed for these massive density bonuses if you built affordable units on site. And people have been utilizing it. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's unclear to me if it's not working or if it's just something like developers just want this because it clearly is going to make developers' lives easier. Mm-hmm. We can say that unequivocally. What we don't know is, like, how well Complete Communities is working as of right this moment. You know, in 2022, KPBS analyzed it and like 800 units had been permitted with 200 of them affordable. So, you know, we could have a debate about whether that's working or not, but it was spurring development as it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there a sort of consensus YIMBY view about all of this change?
I don't know if there's a consensus view. The people I've talked to a lot of people on background involved in city politics around this. And, a lot of them are like, you know, I can see the argument for it because they want more houses because we desperately need more houses. The vacancy rate of rental units is incredibly low. It's awful out there to try to get an apartment. Way more people are becoming homeless than we're getting out of homelessness. Like, we do desperately need the units, but like, we also need fair housing policies. You know what I mean? You know, the developers say, well, this changes the margins so we can build more. Well, I mean, we could just not charge taxes and that would also like change the margins so they could do it, you know? So there, it's a balance between like fair housing principles and getting more housing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can check out that story. Great little dip into housing policy.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. While you pursue some other stuff. And more, voicesandiego.org. Thanks, guys. That was good.
That was awesome.
Yeah, not so bad. You did pretty good today, Scott.
Thanks, Jake. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in this part of San Diego that is pursuing that public service of local journalism and accountability. And you can support that always at voiceofsandiego.org/donate. That's voicesandiego.org/donate. Subscribe to The Morning Report to keep up with everything we're following in local news and our latest stories. You can see that and our full lineup of newsletters at vosd.org/newsletters. That's vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Will Huntsberry is our senior investigative reporter. Jacob McQuinney's our education reporter. And Nate John's our producer, our technician on staff and in studio this week. Is Adam Greenfield. Thank you so much, Adam. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.